listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Rudy Country. Mayor Rudy Giuliani was all but sainted for his leadership after 9/11. 2 decades later, the specters of that event and of the man himself haunt us still. By Atish Tasir, with opening illustration by Nigel Buchanan. Which shows Giuliani dressed in a suit, looking extremely worried, with his right hand wiping his forehead, and he's wearing a pinky ring, and on his ring finger, a 1996 World Series champions New York Yankees ring. On a glittering day in May, ferries and barges charting a course over the diamond-strewn surface of the East River, Richard Ravitch, former Lieutenant Governor of New York, said something extraordinary to me. You have to remember, Giuliani wasn't mayor on 9/11, was he? Ravitch, who had also been chairman of the MTA and a mayoral candidate in 1989, was something of a city elder, an embodiment of its institutional memory. The walls of his office at Waterside Plaza were hung with honorary degrees, yellowed clippings from the New York Post, and a print of the American Museum on Broadway, circa 1850. Did this man, to whom Giuliani in 1995 offered the job of chancellor of the city school system, a post he declined, really not remember who the mayor was when the city he loved so much was attacked? He was 87. I feared his mind was going. But when at my insistence Ravitch realized his mistake, remember America's mayor, Time magazine's person of the year, the defiant figure covered in dust and ash emerging from the rubble of the New York of the World Trade Center, I, in turn, saw that it contained a deeper truth. The grotesqueries of the Giuliani of today, here the supine figure of Borat fame, reaching aimlessly into his trousers, there the bug-eyed death mask of Achenbach and Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, with runnels of hair dye streaming down his cheeks, had erased all memory of the man who went before. Well, it may be, Ravitch said, now a touch embarrassed, that my view of him today has colored my memory. Ravitch added, I don't think Giuliani is an important person. He's a peripheral character. I think he'll be a footnote in the history books of the Trump era. Now I felt he was being disingenuous. Of course, Giuliani is important. It is the 20th anniversary of 9/11. This man had been our hero. Giuliani's performance, my former boss, Eric Pooley, had written in Time after 9/11, ensures that he will be remembered as the greatest mayor in the city's history, eclipsing even his hero, Fiorello LaGuardia, who guided Gotham through the Great Depression. The Queen knighted him. World leaders from Tony Blair to Nelson Mandela toured the site of Ground Zero at his side. The President of France called him Rudy the Rock. There were book deals in the millions and speaking engagements. Giuliani's popularity is national now, wrote Harold Evans in 2001. He is the mayor of America, with the potential of being president one day, if he doesn't screw it up. If 20 years on, we find the man we had lionized for his leadership on that day unfit to represent its memory, not because he is old, infirm, or gracefully losing his marbles, but because he is the face of a Trumpian madness in which great swaths of the country are implicated, that in itself is important. Giuliani's latest, possibly final act in politics is no mere private misfortune. This is not Napoleon's 100 days, or the pathos-filled long kiss goodbye of so many giants, from Teddy Roosevelt to Margaret Thatcher, who find themselves unable to leave the stage when it is time to go. It is too shrewd a political calculation to be that. A recent Economist YouGov poll had the former mayor's popularity among Republicans in the 60s 3 times that of Mitch McConnell's. More important, Giuliani's particular brand of crazy, though more operatic, has afflicted too many GOP leaders in the age of Trump, from Lindsey Graham to Ron Johnson, for it to be seen as an anomaly. As Joe Klein, the author of Primary Colors, put it to me, Rudy is the epitome of what has happened to our public life, and it's scary. People say it's only 30% of the country. 30% is a lot. Even as the fallen symbol of our veneration, Giuliani, who did not respond to multiple requests for comment on this story, would have been important on this anniversary. But as the symptom of a deeper cultural malaise, he becomes something more than that. We are implicated in this fearful last act of his. I'd go so far as to say our national reckoning depends on our ability to make a whole of the diptych Giuliani presents. Now as the hero of 9/11, now as a hero, now as a figure whose madness is not his own, but a national madness, which in part has an origin in the events of that day. The wasteful wars that ensued, the harm done to our social fabric as the nation was diverted by adventurism, and the toll that ultimately took on the psyche of a country that grew every day more suspicious of itself. These were the conditions that engendered Trump. And so, yes, of course, Rudy Giuliani is important. But let's go back for a moment to that September morning when in our vulnerability and fear we clung to Rudy. The memory of that embrace, from which we have been trying to extricate ourselves ever since, may have faded, but the need that inspired it is still intact. It's funny that you call it a Cuomo-like moment, Andrew Kurtzman, Giuliani's biographer, said to me on Zoom, because I thought Cuomo was having a Giuliani-like moment. What Kurtzman found especially comparable about the two situations is how quickly people forget the circumstances behind the rise of these heroic figures. Those circumstances are an atmosphere of totalizing fear combined with a leadership void. Enter a flawed but vigorous leader, seemingly all facts and no bullshit, a man born, as his friend Peter Power said of Giuliani, without a fear gene. Kurtzman had been with Giuliani on 9/11. A young reporter at NY1, he was awakened by his mother, who told him to turn on the television. He called his newsroom, who instructed him to find the mayor. He went downtown in a cab. The driver, as soon as they entered the deserted streets surrounding the World Trade Center, slammed the brakes and threw him out. A frantic woman got in, urging Kurtzman to go back uptown with her. A cop yelled at him to get off the street. Kurtzman waved a press pass and held his ground. "I'm looking for Giuliani," he said. "Oh, Giuliani," the cop replied. "He's over there." The mayor, covered in dust and ash, was emerging from a building on Barclay Street, where he had taken cover after the first tower fell. On seeing Kurtzman, he said, "Come on, Andrew, let's go." They began to walk up Church Street on what is now Giuliani's iconic march north. As they walked, the second tower fell behind them, an implosion of rubble and debris. Everyone ran for cover. "Talk about a terrifying moment," Kurtzman said, "helping me to re-enter the unbelievable experience of that day, its magnitude, the emotions it inspired." Zeroing in on what he saw as the source of the mayor's appeal, Kurtzman said he was the only one who was not absolutely immobilized by fear. Afterward, Giuliani held a press conference where, when asked how many would die, he gave that unspeakably moving reply, "The number of casualties will be more than any of us can bear, ultimately." Kurtzman is at work on a second Giuliani biography to be published next year by Simon and Schuster, and it's not hard to see why. His subject, a child of New York's white ethnic enclaves with all their tribal hatreds and a cult of loyalty as fierce as that found in the honor and shame societies of Afghanistan's frontier regions, was fascinating, even as a young man. Born to a family of Italian immigrants, he grew up first in Brooklyn, later in Garden City, in a world where crime and law enforcement were two sides of the same coin. He had four uncles in uniform. A fifth was a fireman. His father, Harold, was a petty criminal who in 1934, at age 24, had been convicted of robbing a milkman at gunpoint in a Manhattan building. Later, Harold worked as a bartender at Uncle Leo's loan sharking operation. When people couldn't pay up, Harold was the guy who showed up with a baseball bat. Much of this information, including a cousin who was a junkie and another who died as a cop in the line of duty, came to light through the tremendous work of Wayne Barrett, Giuliani's late biographer. These were dichotomies typical of second-generation immigrant families in the city, and it is hard to be sure how much Giuliani himself knew of the equal measures of light and shade contained within him. Certainly now, as law enforcement wraps its arms around him, as this story went to press, a New York court suspended Giuliani's law license, having determined that he made false and misleading statements in an attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 election. There is a special poignancy to Harold imploring the young Rudy to steer clear of a life of crime. He would say over and over, Giuliani told Time in 2001, "You can't take anything that's not yours. You can't steal. Never lie. Never steal." As a child, and even as a young adult, I thought, "What does he keep doing this for? I'm not going to steal anything." The young Rudy, brimming with admiration for John F. Kennedy, was an RFK Democrat. When Hillary Clinton was still a supporter of Barry Goldwater, Giuliani was praising President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty and describing the writings of a member of the John Birch Society as the disgusting, neurotic fantasy of a mind warped by fear and bigotry. He voted for George McGovern in 1972, but 3 years later was appointed Gerald Ford's Associate Deputy Attorney General. In 1981, under Ronald Reagan, he became the youngest Associate Attorney General ever. He only became a Republican, his mother Helen said of him as Giuliani's registration changed from Democrat to Independent to Republican after he began to get all these jobs from them. As Associate Attorney General, he had a shameful record of demonizing Haitians fleeing the murderous regime of Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier. By 1983, he was the youngest man ever to lead the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. Only men had led it then. He kept his lynx-eyed gaze fastened on Italian organized crime, as well as white-collar crime, prosecuting the likes of Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky. His youthful love of opera made him relish the more theatrical aspects of his job. He memorably perp-walked Richard Wigton across the trading floor of his company in handcuffs. "You don't stop violent crime by being a good fairy," Ed Hayes, who served as the model for the Tommy Killian character in Tom Wolfe's The Bonfire of the Vanities, told me. Hayes, who had also grown up hard in an Irish equivalent of Giuliani's Italian neighborhood, fought the mayor on behalf of a firefighter's widow after 9/11 and came away with a favorable impression. "He was a good mayor," Hayes said. "I don't give a shit what anyone says." But recently, he had run into Giuliani at Scotto's, an Italian restaurant in Midtown, and was shocked by what he saw. "I remember looking at him, and he didn't look the same. I said to myself, what the F is going on here? This is one of the great heroes in the history of New York City." Giuliani, who almost became a priest until he discovered he had a libido, had an uncompromising sense of right and wrong that served him well as a prosecutor. After two storied terms as mayor, he launched a 2008 presidential campaign that ran into the sands. Then he disappeared into the private sector, where he made gobs of money. My husband, in fact, was an associate at the esteemed Houston law firm of Bracewell and Giuliani after the latter name had fallen away. So far, so standard. We should stop here to stress that, though more colorful than most, these are the lineaments of a perfectly routine career in public life. Had Giuliani at this point vanished into the mahogany woodwork of boardrooms, Kurtzman would have had no greater task ahead of him than detailing messy divorces, the odd shady deal, a late-in-life love affair with Scotch, and the diminishing returns that accrue to those who try to extract every drop of financial and political gain from a global celebrity they had only a partial hand in creating. But now, as Giuliani comes full circle, via the Trump bypass, to be the subject of a criminal investigation led by the very same office he once led, he becomes a study of almost Dostoevskian proportions. In him, we see some of our most ancient impulses of power and ethics, fear and greed, dramatized. To be clear, in May, Time revealed Giuliani worked with an accused Russian agent in a plot against the 2020 U.S. election. This is a prosecutor who has come to be a danger to his personal liberty as well as that of this country. Even if we set aside the scenes of self-abasement, now but dialing reporters, now possibly emitting COVID-infected fecal aerosols into a crowded Michigan courtroom, this is territory unlike any other in modern times. It is incumbent upon us to try to understand how the arc of this once impressive individual came to intersect so calamitously with this moment that we're living through in America. Because as much as there is nothing mysterious and certainly nothing tragic in Trump's trajectory, even the most partisan observers I spoke to could not help but feel a degree of pain, sadness, and frank bewilderment at the question of what happened to Giuliani. "It's inexplicable to me," said one. "Frontal lobe dementia," said another. "A guy with an expiration date," suggested a former associate. Ravitch said, "A lot of people think he became a heavy drinker, and that's why he's behaving the way he is." A close aide demurred, "It's a sadder, more complicated story. There's something wrong. There's something off. He got nothing out of this relationship. He threw away his reputation for free." "I take great issue," said someone who worked closely with Giuliani in the 1990s, let's call him Jeff, "with the people who say that this is just a continuation of who he was. That's not true. This is the tragic collapse of a great public man." Jeff remembers someone with a steel trap of a mind who could hold briefings of 3 to 4 hours without notes, a big reader, a man capable of compassion. Jeff attended one of a series of town halls Giuliani held around the city during his first term in Canarsie in southern Brooklyn, real Rudy country. There, an older man struggled to get his point across. "Shouts of learn English and stop wasting our time," rose around the packed school auditorium. "Rudy shut that down right away," Jeff said, recalling the mayor's words. "Let me tell you something. This gentleman is an immigrant trying to ask his mayor a question. My grandfather came here. He didn't speak any English. He had a hell of a tough time. If somebody had taken the time to listen, life would perhaps have been easier for him. I'm a busy guy. As busy as you may be, I'm busier than you are. If I have the time to spend a few extra minutes listening to this guy finishing his thought, you do too." Giuliani's reaction changed the tenor of that room. Applause ensued. Jeff was eager for me to see that when it came to the old Rudy, there were as many stories of this kind as of the other. "There was none of that Trumpian nonsense," Jeff said, adding that he found the present condition of the ex-mayor heartbreaking. Giuliani had far more trouble being sympathetic to people from other backgrounds, especially New York's black population, which in his day amounted to more than a quarter of the city. His experience with race has a certain metaphorical power, too, when one considers that in America the encounter with the other so often begins at the color line. That is why when we see people unlike ourselves, and when our ability to see in the experience of another a shade of our own, empathy, in a word, is truly tested. In the case of Giuliani, his racial attitudes were more than casually held prejudices. No mere extension of his upbringing, but an actual vendetta, originating in his 1989 electoral loss to the city's first black mayor, David Dinkins. "He couldn't believe he had lost to Dinkins," said Bill Bratton, who served as police commissioner under Giuliani. Bratton, who had been in the room when President Barack Obama mocked Trump at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011, an event many believe led Trump to truly set his sights on the presidency with an aim to undo Obama's legacy, described that moment to me as the mirror image of the rage that the defeat to Dinkins produced in Giuliani. The future mayor had until then actively courted the black vote, speaking with emotion of homeless shelters and crack babies. But Giuliani's concern lasted only as long as he was allowed to play the benefactor, Confronted with losing to a black man, his goodwill disappeared. At Giuliani's party at the Roosevelt Hotel, Barrett evokes a scene that would return to haunt us. The ballroom was filled with frustrated supporters. He'd closed the campaign invoking, "White, male, and mad." It was also filled with ugly untruths about how blacks had stolen the election at polls in Harlem and Bed-Stuy, where the dead had supposedly voted by the thousands. Not only did Giuliani lack the historical imagination or the generosity of spirit needed to see the significance of New York electing its first black mayor, what is especially revealing, given what he would later become, is that even when he had beaten Dinkins in 1993 on the issue of law and order, he could not let his animosity go. "He really prevented us," Bratton said, still frustrated after all these years, "from having a free hand to reach out to the black community." The animus ran so deep that Giuliani, as mayor, didn't once attend the U.S. Open, because that event had come to be associated with Dinkins' mayoralty. This also meant that when the truly hideous incidents of police violence occurred under Giuliani, the 1997 rape of Abner Louima in a precinct bathroom by cops with the handle of a cleaning implement, Amadou Diallo shot at 41 times in 1999 by plainclothes police officers. Patrick Dorisman, killed in 2000 by undercover officers attempting to buy drugs that Dorisman wasn't selling. The mayor had no one in black leadership to speak to, nor did he seem to want to. Instead, he released Dorisman's juvenile delinquency record to show that he was no altar boy. In fact, he was at the very same Catholic school that Giuliani had attended. Not surprisingly, a month after Dorisman's funeral, Giuliani's approval rating fell to 37%, with only 6% of black voters approving of the job he was doing. Giuliani's flaws are grave enough that I see no point in denying him his due. The fashion today is to say that crime was falling anyway, that the crack epidemic was burning itself out, and that Giuliani was merely the beneficiary of conditions beyond his control. When I put this to Bratton, he said, "To be quite frank, that's a bunch of bullshit." He then assailed me with data about how crime nationwide fell 40% in the 1990s, while in New York it fell 80%. Homicides in the city of 2,000 murders a year went down by 90% and continued, save for 1 year, to drop every year through that decade. All this was the direct result of policies that Giuliani, in tandem with Bratton, an early student of broken windows policing, instituted. That these same policies later had terrible excesses is another story. It is hard to overstate the degree to which the culture of the city changed under his mayoralty, writes Kurtzman. New Yorkers walking to work no longer encountered men urinating on the sidewalk. They no longer traveled in graffiti-covered trains, in which homeless men slept across the seats and peddlers hawked ragged copies of street news. They didn't fear for their safety as they exited onto deserted streets. The parked cars they passed no longer sported signs taped to the windows addressed to car thieves reading "No Radio." And old ladies in the park no longer talked exclusively about who'd been mugged over the weekend. the porn stores vanished from neighborhoods, and drug dealers no longer sold loose joints in children's parks. Another canard in wide circulation is that 9/11 rescued Giuliani from a political wilderness. It did not. In August 2001, he had a roughly 50% approval rating in a city that was 6-1 Democrat. Even so, 9/11 did find him in a strange place. As the city grew safer, cleaner, and more prosperous, its mayor had grown increasingly erratic and unstable. There was the separation from his wife, Donna, which Giuliani sadistically announced at a press conference. There was the very public affair with Judith Nathan, his next wife, who would become his ex-wife. There were the pitched battles with the city's institutions, such as the Brooklyn Museum, which he threatened to defund in 1999 because of an exhibition called Sensation, featuring, among other pieces, the Virgin Mary, created in part with cow dung. Another instance, this one involving a version of the Last Supper that depicted a nude female black Christ, led Saturday Night Live's Tina Fey to joke as Giuliani, "This trash is not the sort of thing that I want to look at when I go to the museum with my mistress." 2 terms on, fatigue had set in. New Yorkers had tired of what Evans described as Giuliani's Thatcher-like difficulty in the calibration of his response to dissent. Here he was at war with jaywalkers, there with New York Magazine, which ran an ad campaign describing itself as possibly the only good thing in New York Rudy hasn't taken credit for. Giuliani had the ads removed from city buses. The magazine sued and won. All this was very much the normal exhaustion visited upon a big figure who has outlived his utility. But 9/11 gave him a golden finish. In the aftermath, Kurtzman told me, I think it's fair to say Giuliani was among the most beloved people in the world. He was knighted by the Queen of England, lauded by prime ministers and presidents from here to Russia. So he was faced with a choice of what to do at that point. And I think the story of Giuliani is largely a story of choices. The choice Giuliani made was to run for president in 2007, and it was around this time that things began to go badly wrong. Giuliani's campaign foundered. Some say it was because he was a pro-gay, pro-choice, pro-gun control candidate from New York's outer boroughs trying to appeal to the red base of his party. But the problem ran deeper than that. Somewhere along the way, his vision had imperceptibly darkened. A meanness had set in. He was anxious to cash in on his 9/11 stock, but on the national stage, it became clear that his ruling passions were the many petty hatreds he had sedulously nursed over a lifetime. Confronted with the challenge of presenting the American people with a vision of the future, he could do no better than substitute values in a formula of resentment that had hardened in him. In the current production, wrote Vanity Fair's Chris Smith in New York in 2007, the part of David Dinkins is played by Hillary Clinton, rampant crime is played by Al-Qaeda, and welfare cheats have been replaced by illegal aliens. Smith then made a judgment about Giuliani that has all the force of prophecy today. He's selling his strength of will, he wrote. As an indispensable trait in a tough world, but we know from 8 years of first-hand experience that Giuliani's strength would also mean degrading his enemies, a contempt for the press and Congress, a mania for secrecy, and the rewarding of personal loyalty at the expense of competence. A Nixonian darkness had taken root in Giuliani. But America, even after the attacks, was still too bright a place to buy it. On October 3, 2001, a few weeks after the attack on the World Trade Center, Osama bin Laden wrote a letter to Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, in which he said, "What takes place in America today was caused by the flagrant interference on the part of successive American governments into others' business. These governments imposed regimes that contradict the faith, values, and lifestyles of the people. This is the truth that the American government is trying to conceal from the American people. Aware that no people lived at a greater remove from the actions of their government than Americans, bin Laden's chief aim in attacking America on September 11th was to draw ordinary Americans out into what he called the arena, the world beyond. Among those who entered the arena was my friend Kwesi Christopher. We had started out as freshmen together in 1999 at Amherst College. Kwesi, who grew up in New York, was of a Trinidadian background and had come to Amherst via Phillips Academy Andover through a scholarship preparatory program called Prep for Prep. At Amherst, he found himself rudderless. In my view, the betrayal of one's class origins that a school like Amherst demands had begun to prey on his mind. By the time the towers came down, he had dropped out, living off campus and selling us drugs. But he was a patriot, and when war came, he joined the 10th Mountain Division, stationed at Fort Drum, New York, and deployed to Afghanistan. He returned home safely after one tour, but had trouble adjusting to normal life and found soldiering suited him. Far from closing the gap between American citizens and the actions of their government, 9/11 had given rise to a cynical new form of warfare that was increasingly contractor-driven. America would rather spend money than blood, Chidozie Uguama, Kwesi's best friend, said to me when I called him to ask about the last days of our mutual friend. And if you spend money on contractors and put them in the most dangerous situations, then their blood doesn't count. Kwesi deployed to Iraq with a South African contractor on March 31, 2007, as part of a convoy offering close protection to a senior official. He was killed by a roadside bomb. That futility is the true legacy of 9/11. If there is something fitting in that, 20 years on, the man most associated with that day is too debased a figure to speak on its behalf. It is because 9/11 itself has not aged well. We mourn those we lost, as well as those who, like Kwesi, fell later. But we mourn them in the knowledge that 9/11 was no Pearl Harbor. No edifying principle or cause arose out of the events of that terrible day. There was nothing heroic about the wars that followed. We were attacked by 19 men, of whom 15 were citizens of Saudi Arabia, a U.S. ally, and the chief financier of the global jihad. We stumbled into aimless, ruinous conflict, exacting revenge a hundredfold from people who had nothing to do with that attack. Eventually, we tired, even as great swaths of the Muslim world lay in ruins. That futility, that cynicism, has a price, not just in blood and treasure, but in spirit. We now know what the result can be when trust is broken, as it most surely was after 9/11. And when I ask Chidozie if Kwesi supported the war in Iraq, he assumed I meant, would he support it now? knowing what we know. If Kwesi were alive today, Chidozie said, he would probably have voted for Donald Trump. September 11th hardened us. It prepared the ground for America to buy a vision of the world that it had not been prepared to buy when Giuliani was selling it. As 2016 rolled around, the rise of Trump coincided with a further deterioration in Giuliani, who'd always had, due in part to a childhood spent around wise guys and petty criminals, a penchant for shady characters. In the past, his taste for sleaze had been kept in check by the many first-rate people he surrounded himself with. That balance now fell apart. Rumors abounded of him holding forth at his house in Bridgerton, a cigar between his teeth, railing drunkenly against the Clintons. The monochrome vision that resulted from growing up in a world where everyone was either a cop or a mobster, and which served him so well as a prosecutor, became hostage to private vendettas. He channeled the same passion he once had for locking up bad guys into doing down his enemies. He was an angry, bitter old man with a flickering halo and financial worries on the horizon. Stumbling about in the footlights like an aging star of the silent screen, he saw in Trump a path back into the limelight. Not as a main player, of course, but an attendant lord, a bit ridiculous, at times indeed the fool. His moral compass may have eroded beyond all recognition, but his political instincts had not deserted him. Having not endorsed anyone early out of loyalty to both Jeb Bush and Chris Christie, and driven by a congenital dislike of Ted Cruz, Rudy fell into the arms of the only one who'd have him. "Why not Donald?" was the sentiment expressed to friends and former aides who tried to steer him away. Giuliani, today, presents a ghoulish spectacle, but we cannot entirely avert our gaze from this deranged figure, strutting and fretting his final hour upon the stage, hurled headlong from the Empyrean blue to bottomless perdition. After all, he is a mnemonic of sorts. In him, we trace an arc from the events of that day, September 11th, 2001, to now, 20 years later, when we can see in granular detail the full horror of a country that has proved unequal to its memory. As Bratton, who still has the CD set of La Boheme that Giuliani gave him, put it, "It's a personal tragedy, but it's also an American tragedy." Rule of Men. When audiences first saw Fight Club, they had no idea they were gazing into a crystal ball of 21st century masculinity. By Lily Annalick, with photographs by Merrick Morton. Opening photo shows a movie set with cameras trained on a fight scene. Let's break all the rules, or at least rules 1 and 2. Let's talk about Fight Club. The movie, released in 1999, is directed by David Fincher and based on a novel published in 1996 by Chuck Palahniuk. It stars Brad Pitt and Edward Norton playing, respectively, the id named Tyler Durden and the superego named Jack, though that name is theoretical as he's never actually addressed by it. A man in the midst of an identity crisis. And Helena Bonham Carter playing Marla Singer, the woman in love with them/him. I could tell you what Fight Club is about, but that would be like imposing a plot on a dream. And in any case, I don't need to tell you, since Tyler Durden's kiss, a soft press of lips followed by cooling saliva, followed by burning lie, has been seared into our consciousness just as it's been seared into Jack's flesh. You already know it, even if you haven't seen it. Fight Club is a masterpiece, but a repellent one, visually gorgeous, spiritually ugly, and brilliant, yet of severely limited intelligence. Its politics are reactionary, its attitudes toward women crude, Neanderthal even. And at the time it came out, it was largely ignored by audiences, savaged by critics. The usually mild-mannered Roger Ebert declared it macho porn. Ebert's right. It is. Though he's wrong to see that as a flaw. No, the movie's explicit misogyny is a source of its unsettling and unsavory greatness. Fight Club is something more than great, too. It's prophetic. To watch it in 2021 is to realize that you were gazing into a crystal ball when you saw it in 1999. The Crystal Ball Checklist, 9/11. Fight Club ends where it begins, with the destruction of those monuments to late-stage American capitalism, in other words, skyscrapers, by a group of terrorists. 2 years almost to the day after its premiere at the Venice Film Festival on September 10, 1999, the Twin Towers would be reduced to piles of smoldering rubble by a group of terrorists. The alt-right. Like most movements, the alt-right attracts its followers by overtly appealing to their self-righteousness, covertly appealing to their self-pity. The alt-right talks tough, comes on with a swagger and a sneer. Really, though, it's a cult of victimhood, one big boo-hoo number about how hard it is to be white and male. Says Tyler to his followers, "I see the strongest and smartest men who've ever lived. I see all this potential, and I see squandering, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves with white collars. We've all been raised on television to believe that one day we'd all be movie gods and rock stars. But we won't. And we're slowly learning that fact, and we're very, very pissed off." And what are the Space Monkeys, Tyler's band of proto-fascist foot soldiers, but the original Proud Boys? Men's rights groups. As Tyler sees it, society has it in for men. It's the old schoolyard taunt, girls rule, boys drool, except the whole country is the schoolyard. In his view, there's no such thing as toxic masculinity. Or, rather, masculinity is only toxic when it's bottled up, allowed no release, which is why he started Fight Club. He believes that for men, spiritual salvation is achieved through physical violence. And though not homosexual, au contraire, Tyler's a stud muffin supreme. He is homosocial. Women aren't to be trusted. Men are better off sticking with their own kind. The sole maternal presence in Fight Club is Bob, identified by his bitch tits, a former bodybuilder whose overuse of steroids has resulted in testicular cancer, and in whose bosomy embrace Jack occasionally seeks solace. Men's rights groups, many of which have adopted Fight Club as their Bible, Tyler Durden Lives is a frequent post on their message boards, Think Tyler's on the Money. The breakup of Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. Pitt and Aniston weren't married, never mind divorced, in 1999. Fight Club, though, already knew the couple was doomed. I want to have your abortion, a love struck, or possibly cock struck, Marla says to Tyler. This very nasty movie's idea of a sweet nothing. Actually, the line, which appears in Palahniuk's book and Jim Oles' screenplay, was cut at the insistence of a horrified Laura Ziskind, one of Fight Club's producers, who agreed to accept whatever Fincher came up with as an alternative. The alternative, I haven't been effed like that since grade school, horrified her even more. But she'd given her word. When it was announced in the press that Pitt and Aniston were separating, actor Eva Longoria was photographed in a T-shirt that said, "I'll have your baby, Brad." It was her response to the rumor, unfounded and unfair, incidentally, that Aniston's unwillingness to start a family was the reason for the split. It's also a riff, even if unknowing, on Palahniuk's original dialogue. Millennials. Tyler is very specifically targeting members of Generation X when he gives what is perhaps his most famous speech. We're the middle children of history. We have no great war, no great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our great depression is our lives. In 1999, we Xers, I'm one too, born in 1978, were already getting crushed by the boomers, the largest generational group the U.S. ever produced, boring us to tears with their self-important hippie shit, their endless blather about how epic the 60s were, man. That Xers would get crushed from the other side by millennials, an even larger generational group, and a sorrier collection of spoiled, rotten crybabies you've never seen in your life. It's not fair, their anthem and cri de coeur. It's something nobody could have anticipated back then. Except somehow Tyler did. Donald Trump. Donald Trump is Tyler Durden minus, obviously, the face, the bod, the hair, the style. By the way, Donald Trump isn't quite an anagram of Tyler Durden, but it's close. Like Tyler, Trump uses snowflake as a put-down. In fact, Trump possibly boosted it from Tyler. Or so says Chuck Palahniuk. "You are not a beautiful and unique snowflake," is a line Tyler lays on the Space Monkeys. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.